About 2 years ago, I was asked by the Central Conference of American Rabbis to chair a task force on Jewish identity. 2 years ago, the issue of Jewish identity somehow emerged out of the centers of Jewish life. There were commissions and task forces and study groups all revolving around this theme. Now, when I began to think about Jewish identity, I was a little nonplussed because my first impression was that Jewish identity had to do with something that labeled us from the outside as Jews, and it was very clear that none of these commissions and task force, be they from federation groups or centers or the synagogues, were concerned that you could no longer pick a Jew out of a crowd. That we were no longer that distinctive in our dress or that distinctive in our accent. Identity is an interesting word. It comes from two Latin terms, idem, which means the same, sameness, and iter, which means to do it again, as reiterate, to do more, to be more of the same. And it was clear that the term Jewish identity emerged out of a concern by this generation of Jews that there might not be a next generation of Jews, more of the same. It was part of what came to be called an agenda of Jewish survival, a concern that the young people should continue behind us in that long link of the generations which have made for the nearly 4,000 years of Jewish history. And as I understood this basis for the term, I began to understand the concerns from which it emerged. It seemed to be emerging primarily from a growing concern with the rate of Jewish intermarriage and outmarriage. It emerged by what people believed was a growing rate of marriage between young Jews and young non-Jews. Now, there is no means of proving statistically that this rate had, in the last decade or two, risen precipitously. We have very inadequate records of matters such as this. But there were increasing numbers in the Jewish community who were facing the fact that their children were bringing home someone who was not Jewish as their intended mate. And somehow the assumption was that if these young Jews had had a stronger Jewish identity, more knowledge of Judaism, happier experiences in their religious school or in their youth activities, if they'd been more conscious of the fact of being Jewish, they would not, in fact, be choosing a non-Jewish life partner. Now, this assumption, I hasten to add, has never been proven out. From my own experience in these matters, I can testify to the fact that there are any number of young Jews who had happy experiences in religious school, who had been very much involved in youth activities, even young people who came out of good experiences in all-day Jewish environments, schools, who were nevertheless coming home with a non-Jewish partner and who felt that they were in no way being disloyal to Judaism, nor that they were, in fact, denying their Jewishness. They could find no reason to believe that their Jewishness was in any way threatened because they had chosen to fall in love with and marry someone who was not Jewish. But the conventional wisdom of these years has it that there is something lacking in the identity, the sense of Jewish self-worth of many young people, and that therefore somehow the religious schools, the Sabbath schools, the youth activities, the centers, all of these institutions of Jewish life have failed or are failing. It's been a time when any number of community commissions began to criticize this and that and the other rather severely in these activities. on the assumption that if they only did their jobs better, that we would in fact be able to staunch the rate of intermarriage. Now, there is no doubt that every school in the land and every center in the land and every youth activity in the land could always do better. That's the very nature of any human institution. But whether or not improvement of the quality of activity, of service, of classroom, of presentation would in fact markedly affect the rate of intermarriage has never been shown to be true. It may be true. It may not be true. At the same time that all of our institutions were concerned with this agenda of Jewish survival, these task forces on Jewish identity, the Central Conference of American Rabbis, the group of Reform rabbis in America, was obviously equally concerned. And its concerns tended to focus not only on the larger issues of Jewish learning, Jewish schooling, youth activities, and the like, but it concerned on one specific pressure point in our daily professional activities. And that had to do with the role of the rabbi in an intermarriage, or the non-role of the rabbi in an intermarriage. In the very early days of our professional group, the 1890s, the rabbis had decided that there was no role for one of their colleagues in an intermarriage. This is a traditional position. The rabbi is, or whoever solemnizes a marriage, is called in the Jewish tradition a Mesader Kiddushin, one who organizes the peculiar Jewish sanctity of this arrangement. The rabbi in this role is in his role as the resource person, the scholar in the Jewish community, telling how this sacred moment should be organized, Kedat Moshe of Israel, under and within the customs and the religious faith of Israel. The rabbi is not a marrying Sam. And there was, it was believed then, no reason for the rabbi to participate in a marriage which was not being structured within the sanctities of Jewish life. Now, one of the great differences between our liberal Jewish tradition and that of the medieval world, the tradition, it's the Orthodox tradition, was that we have no ways of enforcing by cherem, by excommunication or otherwise, these decisions. And from very early on, there were a small number of rabbis who disagreed, who performed intermarriages, some because they were pressured by congregations and congregants, some because they felt very strongly that they were bringing people closer by entering and helping them at this critical point in their lives, some out of a concern that their major role was to show love and empathy and sympathy, and that they had to show this at that moment in the young people's lives. Whatever the reason, this division between the large majority who followed the tradition and the small minority who did not remained a rather constant number down to our day. But in the 1950s and 1960s, as there seemed to be more requests for rabbis to participate in intermarriages and greater pressure on rabbis from congregations and congregants to do so, those who performed intermarriages asked the conference to deal with the issue again. And over a three-year period ending 2 years ago, there were protracted debates and papers and convocations, and the sum and substance was that the Central Conference reaffirmed its traditional position, and those rabbis who had not performed intermarriage continued not to perform intermarriages, and those rabbis who performed intermarriages continued to perform intermarriages. Now, one of the significant byproducts of this debate was a growing awareness by rabbis and congregants alike that our movement had not faced up to a problem which was coming more and more to the fore. We didn't have good answers, clear answers, distinct answers to the question, why should a young Jew, any Jew, remain Jewish? What advantage was there to the individual for being Jewish? How did it make him distinctive? In Jewish life, in the more traditional societies, the question had never had to be asked. A Jew was a Jew was a Jew. Everybody knew what a Jew was. You were a Jew was stamped on your passport. You were a Jew by birth. You were a Jew in the eyes of the state. You were a Jew in the eyes of your non-Jewish neighbors. You were a Jew in your own eyes. You never asked why you were a Jew. You simply were a Jew. There were learned Jews and not so learned Jews. There were pious Jews and not so pious Jews, but a Jew was a Jew was a Jew. And the question of why be Jewish never emerged. But it has emerged, obviously. We live in a free society. We live in a heterogeneous cultural environment. And the question is, what virtue is there in maintaining this traditionally distinctive and separate role? Why should the Jewish minority remain? What's the virtue of it? If the virtue of Jewish life is a kind of social sensitivity, a sensitivity to civic and communal problems, and there's certainly that in the liberal Jewish tradition, which often defined itself in terms of prophetic Judaism, an activist, politically activist Judaism, a socially concerned Judaism. What was the difference between this kind of social awareness and the kind of social involvement one could have through Common Cause, the American Civil Liberties Union, or an organization of this type? And if the distinctiveness of Judaism lay in the diet, anyone can go into a delicatessen and eat so-called Jewish food. And if the distinctiveness of the Jew lay in some kind of lifestyle, this generation and the last found very little that was distinctive, tangibly, visibly, distinctively Jewish in their homes. Their homes were not filled with Jewish practice, and they were decreasingly filled with the peculiar Jewish insights which made for distinctiveness in our community. Liberal Judaism emerged with emancipation. Liberal Judaism begins in the early 19th century when, for the first time in Central and Western Europe, the Jews begin to be accepted as citizens of the larger state. The very first thrust of liberal Judaism is an attempt to belong, an attempt to do away with many of those particularistic phenomena of Jewish life which had grown up in the ghetto, grown up when we were a community set apart. And the whole drive was to try to join the larger community, to do away with a sense of particularism and to enlarge, to discover again the universalism, the humanism within the Jewish tradition. And so it was that among liberal Jews, the traditional language, whether it be Hebrew or Yiddish, was put away, and the language of the nation of which we were a part, German, French, English, was adopted. So it came about that the traditional hubbub of a traditional service was reshaped into aesthetic forms that were similar to those which were seen in the churches of the world around them. And so it was that a doctrine like the doctrine of the chosen people began to be forgotten, put aside, and a doctrine such as that of the brotherhood of mankind was enlarged and became to the fore. And wherever you turned in the liberal Jewish tradition, what was being emphasized was those things that we shared with all others. We were not different. We were, in fact, the same. And our difference was really only that we had a special religious calendar that for a few moments of the year, we touched again our traditional base. And this tradition, this urge to belong, this drive to find the universal within the Jewish tradition, remained the dominant theme within the liberal Jewish tradition for a century or more. The problem is, of course, that when you emphasize brotherhood, you've got to have somebody who wants to be your brother. And though in the United States we move rather consistently into greater and greater participation in the larger society, and a greater and greater sense that we were in fact accepted by the larger society, elsewhere in the world, we had the pogroms, and we had Kishinev, we had the rise of Stalin, we had the rise of fascism and Nazism. The Jew was no more accepted because he had adopted this tradition of universalism. He was emphasizing the ties which he felt with the larger community. And the great crisis of philosophy, of approach, emerged in our people, in our liberal tradition over the creation of a national Jewish home, over Zionism. This was the first time that the liberal Jewish community had to confront a particularist issue. It came to us from the outside, politically, but there it was. And many within the Reform movement could not put away this need to belong, to feel the same as. And in the 1920s and 1930s, perhaps a majority of those who belonged to liberal congregations in the United States were either lukewarm or actively opposed to all those who talked of a yeshuv, a return by Jews to a national home in what was then called Palestine. This was to identify us again. It seemed to set us apart again. Now, with Hitler, with the Holocaust, with the war, all of us came to recognize the significance of a place of refuge, the importance of this state psychologically and emotionally and otherwise for our community, as nothing else, as a great symbol of the possibility of renewal, the possibilities of life itself. But within our own homes, within our own lives, the liberal Jews involved themselves now in the Jewish community, and though they took their share of leadership responsibilities vis-a-vis Soviet Jews, vis-a-vis the needs of the Middle East and Israel, within the context of their own private lives, their homes retained this thrust towards being like everyone else. Part of it was inevitable. Generation after generation went to the community's schools, to the public schools and of the community. Generation after generation was exposed to the media and the literature and the theater of the larger community. Its language became second nature to us. Its frame of value reference became to a large degree ours. And all that seemed to be distinctive seemed to be disappearing. It had been distinctive that the Jewish home was a closely knit place. Well, as generations shaded into generation, the Jewish home became torn apart by the pressures of modern life as any other home. The rates of alcoholism, the rates of divorce, the rates of social disintegration, which have characterized America in the last 20 or 25 years, showed up a generation perhaps behind, but showed up nevertheless in our homes. And when our young people came to grips, as each one in turn had to come to grips with the question, why should I be Jewish? What is there of advantage to me in remaining a Jew? He was faced, or she was faced, with the fact that she was hard put to find within the context of her life or his life something that tangible, visible, that was clearly distinct and was clearly appreciated, clearly was of significance. Our generation, that is the middle-aged generation of Jews, has been kept at being Jewish by external pressures largely. We are Jewish because of the Middle East, four Arab wars. We are Jewish because of political concerns in Israel and the Soviet Union, the Argentine, wherever it may be, because of the traumatic events of the Holocaust and all that represents. But these are all external to us. These are the pressures that come in from the outside. And when our young grow in a community where there is prosperity and degree of security, when they have not lived through the Holocaust, that's ancient history to them, these external events are not of similar pressure, similar consequence to them. And they do not understand always that this is enough. They want something more. They want a warmth, they want a piety, they want a sense of ethical distinctiveness. They want to know that there's some virtue in being distinctive. It's not simply being forced on us from the outside. Well, that's the problem. And to try and find some answers, some explanations, some programs, some approaches which might be useful, this task force which I had took as its first mandate to understand exactly where we were, what the problem seemed to be. Because though many of us felt we could frame it sociologically and we could understand it in terms of history, we were not sure that we were not projecting our own limitations, our own environment, our own assumptions onto what in fact exists. Each of us undertook one body of work, and one of the members of our group undertook to listen to a largish number of Reformed Jewish congregants, to have them talk as openly and as willingly as they would about the reasons that they belong to a congregation, about their feelings about being Jewish, about those explanations which satisfied them and which they hope would satisfy their children about, you know, why be a Jew. And a series of interviews were held in New York, Richmond, Virginia, and here in Cleveland. In each case, people were chosen from two congregations, a large, well-established congregation and a newer, smaller congregation. The interviewer was a single person, the same person in each case, and the conversations were open-ended. He tried simply to keep the conversation centered on the questions at hand. We tried to bring into each of these discussions people of various age groups, and we insisted that there be in each discussion at least two people, one from each congregation, who was not at all active in the life of the congregation, who was a typical member who was present but not, who belonged but did not actively participate. But what did we discover? We discovered, as we reread the tale of the tapes, that no one joined a Reform congregation because they had examined the philosophy of Reform and its pronouncement and agreed with them. In fact, with the exception of one religious school teacher in one congregation, no one even really knew that there were such pronouncements. One joined a congregation largely because it was convenient, because there was a general acceptance of its position, because one's friends belonged, because the rabbi seemed to be a bright or nice fellow. There was a general acceptance of the proposition that if we lived in a small town where there was only one congregation, we would have no trouble joining that one congregation. What else could we do? In other words, we were Jews. And we joined a congregation not because of its theological position, but we joined it for a series of other far more practical reasons. Why did we accept the proposition that we were Jews? Largely because we felt that this was the way. The pressures were coming still from the outside. When do you feel most Jewish? That was a question that was often asked. And the answer was, in one case, I feel most Jewish when I'm among Jews. Another answer was, when the seventh game of the World Series happens on Rosh Hashanah. The definition is determined from the outside. And when the young rabbi who was conducting these discussions attempted to focus on theological questions, you know, I'm a Jew because I believe in God. I'm a Jew because I believe in the mission of Israel. I'm a Jew because I believe in the Torah and its continuing validity. All of the discussions shied away. These were not the issues of primary concern. These were not in the forefront. In the forefront was the question of providing religious education for my children. In the forefront was the question of some kind of symbolic identification with the Jewish people. That was terribly important. In each discussion, someone said, you know, when I go traveling, I look for Jews. In each discussion, someone said, I feel very Jewish when I hear somebody speak a Yiddish word or sing a melody which I recognize from Israel or from the synagogue. We belong because we have a kind of basic sympathy, both with the Jewish people and with a liberal tradition, but we don't really understand what it stands for, its inner content. We belong because we want our children to belong. But the parade is always here on Sunday morning, as in every congregation throughout the land. We bring our children, we drop our children for a religious school, and we turn and go home, or go to the tennis courts, or go for a cup of coffee. We do not come in to religious worship. We have here the explanation of why, though congregations are religious institutions, and though the central act of any religious institution is obviously public worship, of all the activities of a synagogue, public worship is one of those which is among the least attended and least popular. The synagogues are, to a large degree, community centers. I don't mean by that they are recreational institutions. But everything else has a popularity which is not accorded by the large majority of congregants to the worship service itself. Obviously, the worship service raises questions of faith, raises affirmations about truth, about ethics, about a particular moral perspective which this generation of Jews is at least apparently not yet prepared to face. We define liberal Judaism if we can take these conversations as being a good indication of where the average Reformed Jew is. We define Reformed Judaism by what we see happening within our congregation. That is what is immediately apparent to us. Reformed Judaism is what our rabbi says it is. Reformed Judaism is what our ritual committee allows to happen. Reformed Judaism is the curriculum which we hold in our religious school. There is very little sense that there's a larger movement out there, and it is obvious that those congregations which are most determined to maintain standards, to make a clear statement about religious standards, are those which are most effective in establishing the fact that liberal Judaism is not simply a minimal kind of belonging to the Jewish faith, but that it has a program, it has priorities, and it has principles which are basic to it. There's a need to relate to things which are tangible and which are real. And though many of these people, especially those who came from Richmond, which is an old line, you know, almost still classical Reformed congregation, many of these had trouble with the particular rituals that a rabbi or a congregant or a congregation was introducing into its worship. Almost everyone said, yes, rituals are important. None of them was in favor of an old-fashioned sort of ethical culture Unitarian service where there would be a total absence of that which was ritual, that which was visible, that which was symbolic. One man said when they talked about rituals, you know, rituals are a little bit like chewing gum. They stick to children. And it's a very graphic way of saying that children and we, the adults, define to a large degree that which is Jewish as the lighting of candles, the objects on a Seder table, those things, the Kiddush cup, those things which we know, which we see in a synagogue, and which we associate with Jewish life. There's a new acceptance of ritual. Many say, well, we don't want to go back, we want to create, but there was an acceptance of ritual of the definable, and a feeling that unless we found some way to define Judaism visibly, symbolically, clearly, the next generation would not have anything really to hang on to. What I found lacking in these discussions was any recognition that if all Judaism is a Kiddush cup and candles and a few objects on the Seder table, a few rituals, there's really nothing to hang on to in any case, because these are simply symbols of larger truths, symbols of a faith stance, of an ethical stance, which must have specific value, bite, meaning, definition, if it is to have any long-staying power. What we found, in other words, as we reread these tapes, was a recognition by the people that their lives were complex, that they lived in a heterogeneous society, that they had not resolved, and in fact, many had been unwilling to confront the questions of faith, that religion was to them largely an identification with the people, that the sense of Jewish history, of its continuity, was very strong, that the sense that Jewish life today needed to pull together for a series of political pressure, reasons, that problems which confront us, was very apparent, that when push came to crunch as far as international issues are concerned, there would be a rallying around, but that when it came to dealing with that which is at the very heart of the religious enterprise, that which has to do with the search for God, that which has to do with establishing a pattern of life, a Jewish lifestyle, which is clear and distinct and tangible, almost none of the people who spoke had really tried to work through this kind of development. The questions were asked. We love to talk about the problems. There were a number of solutions offered. But very few people were able to say honestly, my family, however they wanted to put it, have really begun not simply to think here or again about a particular problem, but we've begun to try and live a really Jewish life. And I left off reading the transcript with this conviction, that we really do not face a crisis of Jewish survival, largely thanks to the political problems which exist out there. That Jewish life will sustain itself for this generation at least, and probably for the next, because those who are out there are forcing us to find ourselves, to be ourselves, and to react to the crises, the challenges which confront us. We're going to be given another generation or so to face up to the larger issue. And that is, how can we find within the Jewish tradition those graceful and generous and ennobling values which are there, and weave these into the pattern of our lives so that we are not simply another group of middle Americans, another group of people who live and struggle and die, but that we are people whose lives, whose families, whose activities are graced with generosity of spirit, and sensitivity and empathy to others, and courage in the cause of justice, and piety, deep faith in God. That's the challenge. And it will not be met, I feel, simply by tinkering with a religious curriculum here, school curriculum here, or a Jewish Center program there, or having another set of papers on the sociology of Jewish life. If Jews really want to be Jews, then we've got to be Jews and to rediscover through study and discussion what Jewish life is all about, and to determine to weave into the fabric of our homes and of our private lives a regimen of practice, a set of standards, which will define our lives as being Jewish. Because I am convinced that when a youngster emerges from a home where the father and the mother have taken and lived a life which in some way or other is clearly and distinctively Jewish, there is an indelible impress on the youngster of the value of being Jewish. He may rebel for a period of time, as we all do, against the values of the home, but he'll never go very far because he understood that it was vital, it was powerful, and it was significant. But I'm equally convinced that when a youngster leaves the average American Jewish home, where Jewishness consisted of a few foods, perhaps a Seder, gripes about religious school, explanations to the 8-year-old of why, if he's being sent to religious school, I don't have to go as the adult to the synagogue. When he comes out of our average home, which is in no way different than the home of any other person on the street, Jew or non-Jew, there's nothing to relate it to. There's nothing to say to this young person, yes, it was worth it, and it will be worth it. What I see about me here and there are small groups of Jews who are trying to make the search and trying to live the Jewish life. It's not easy. But I think somehow in that search, in their discoveries, in their homes, lies the secret of Jewish survival. In any case, I will, from time to time, talk to you about some of these things that we're working on and we discover, because they go to the heart of all that our congregation, all congregations, are about. It's one of the more interesting of the tasks I've undertaken in recent years. And I hope in time we will find in these studies answers to some of these questions, and I assure you, when I find the answers, you'll be the first to hear about them. And now with that, the time is getting late. Let me make one or two announcements.